Welcome to Health Compass. I'm your host, Maya Adam, Director of Health Media Innovation at Stanford Medicine.
Sometimes people think, oh, it's just about living to 100 or living to 105, but these folks are living well to those ages, which is something as I've studied aging, and one of the reasons I'm interested in aging is not just, of course, how long you live, but really more importantly, the quality of life.
Today, we're talking about something we all have to deal with inevitably, aging. As someone who's already starting to send kids off to college, I'm definitely entering a new phase of my own life, and healthy aging is something I think about a lot. I still feel young at heart, and I still have big dreams for the future, so I've been wondering, to what extent is aging something that's in our own hands? How do our behaviors and actions, even the people we surround ourselves with, how does that affect how we age? Today, I'm joined by David Rakopf, a social epidemiologist whose research specializes in aging and longevity. In particular, David's work focuses on places known as blue zones, areas in the world where people tend to live extraordinarily long lives. So what can we learn from these places? David, I'm so looking forward to digging into that question with you. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Before we start talking about blue zones, David, I'm wondering if you can tell me a bit about how you got into this line of work.
Yeah, happy to. I think most people don't, most kindergartners don't think they want to be a social epidemiologist when they grow up. So
start by telling us, what is a social epidemiologist?
Yeah, sure. So a social epidemiologist is someone who studies how social and economic environments affect people's health. And they use the kind of quantitative mathematical tools of epidemiology to look at how those kind of exposures affect people's health.
And how did you get into this field?
So I grew up in Washington State, and I spent a lot of time in sort of rural areas. I did a lot of sort of camping as a kid with my family and with Boy Scouts. And I just saw a lot of places around the state. And I think one of the things that hit me as a young kid was just how different those places were and how different people's lives were in different parts of the state. I think in particular, I spent a lot of time hiking near tribal lands, Native American reservations, the Quileute, the Quinault. There's like 29 recognized tribes in Washington State. And I remember some of those places where I went seeing just, you know, amazing architecture, the longhouses, amazing places, and really vital, thriving communities. And then there were other places around the state, other Native American reservations, where they weren't thriving and when there was really high poverty. And so I just saw those kind of differences, and I think they were in the back of my mind as a kid. And so as I developed my academic interests and had a few other experiences, just sort of got interested in trying to understand why that was.
And David, so you've spent a lot of time in these blue zones. Can you tell us a little bit about these parts of the world and, you know, what makes them special and, you know, what are the real estate prices like there in case we all want to move there?
Well, interestingly, the real estate prices are pretty low. They don't tend to be sort of expensive areas or, very developed areas. So there's a few things that are in common. They tend to be sort of more rural. They tend to not have a super high, fast pace of life. And people tend to be very active. They have sort of close communities. And so they tend to be sort of more isolated populations, either an island or somewhere up in the mountains. A few attributes like that they have in common.
So, David, tell us a little bit more about what it's like to be there.
Yeah. So, the one where I've done the most research on is the Blue Zone in Costa Rica in Nicoya. And I traveled around, meeting with people who were in the areas that I study. So part of what I do is I just have data that we've collected that's sort of anonymous. But then I've also gone to visit there myself. And, you know, it definitely strikes you as a place where things slow down a little bit. You know, there's a lot of places in the world that are like that, but definitely slower. And then again, this kind of sweet spot where a lot of the sort of Western diet, fast food things haven't come in yet. So there were no sort of convenience stores, no chain stores. The other thing about them that was notable is that the way people moved around. So there, people walked, people kind of moved naturally. Some of the things that just have stuck in my head was like the number of folks who were older, and by older, I mean in their 90s or over a 100, who I saw out working in their garden, you know, sweeping their porch, you know, out there all day long being pretty active. So sometimes people think, oh, it's just about living to 100 or living to 105, but these folks are living well to those ages, which is something as I've studied aging. And one of the reasons I'm interested in aging is not just, of course, how long you live, but really more importantly, the quality of life.
That's interesting. It also makes me wonder about the value of sort of being useful, whether there's almost a longevity promoting benefit of having a role to play in the household, like sweeping the porch or looking after the grandchildren.
Yeah, I think that's very important. So that seems to be consistent across the blue zones. And then I'll also say in other research I did just in the US, just in the general population, having sort of a sense of purpose came up as one of the top 10 predictors of living longer and having a longer life expectancy. So it's something that, you know, compared to diet and exercise, we don't have as much data on, but there's pretty, there's, you know, information from the blue zones and then from a few studies and emerging information that is pretty important.
So David, what would a day in the life of someone in Nicoya look like? Let's say an older person.
So, it's a pretty fantastic average day. There's sort of spending time with friends, spending time with your family, doing some household chores, spending a lot of time cooking. You know, what I saw was, you know, not buying a lot of prepared foods, having like a few hours sometimes to cook, but cooking with family and friends. So having it as a social activity. And so, you know, and then walking places. So I met a lot of people that would, you know, even if it was a few miles away or a mile away, maybe they didn't have a car, but would walk over to their family's house or friend's house. And so we've also done some research about those kind of social connections and how people who lived in terms of telomere length, and we could talk about that later, but some of the biological changes that we saw, people didn't have those biological advantages or those positive changes if they were socially isolated. So to me, that tells me that something about how connected people are to other people in Nicoya was really important.
So would you say, I know it's difficult to say, but would you say that the social connections, the social behaviors are kind of the secret sauce? Or is it the food intake, or is it the genetics, or a combination of all of those?
Yeah, I would say it's definitely a combination of all of those, you know, all of them, all of those things that come together. But I think the social connections can be reinforcing of sort of positive diet, positive physical activity, positive emotion. You know, there's a lot of research, and this is just kind of common sense as well, that, you know, if you're in an environment that has a lot of negative influences on health, everyone around you is not eating well, everyone around you is really sedentary, and you're connected with all those people, you know, that might not be a good thing. But the fact that folks there are, you know, have the positive diet, the physical activity, that's people are more active, and then are connected with each other, all of those things really kind of benefit each other and reinforce each other, I would say.
And David, if you took someone hypothetically, or maybe you have studied this as well, mm-hmm. somebody who, let's say, lived or was born in one of these blue zones and then got a job in like a corporate Manhattan mm-hmm. type of setting, what yeah. happens to that kind of person?
For the most part, people tend to sort of take on the health profile of the place where they move to. So you bring a little bit with you, you know, maybe you're a little bit better off, but for the most part, you kind of, people are pretty adaptable, in good and bad ways to sort mm-hmm. of new environments. And that's a positive thing. So if we make environments better and healthier for people, you know, people can get healthier, but it also can go the other way that you, you mentioned.
That's interesting. So I wonder then about, you know, how much the culture is actually also contributing to this protective influence that we're seeing in these zones. Would you say that that's a big part of the equation?
Yeah, it absolutely is. So all of those things come together. And they come together in somewhat unique ways. I mean, there are differences between the blue zones or sort of high longevity areas. But there is something sort of overall in those places that, you know, kind of continues over time. There are some concerns about some of the blue zones, you know, that may be ending in terms of sort of Western diets coming in or that mm-hmm. culture changing or modernization that, you know, not all modernization is bad, but sort of the type of modernization that's, you know, detrimental to health, in particular, sort of in the type of food people eat and how active they are.
So, David, I'm curious about what it was like sort of to be welcomed into these blue zones as a foreigner to the area. Did you feel welcomed right from the beginning? What was that experience like?
Yeah, I mean, I did. I think the first blue zone that I went to was in Sardinia in Italy. And the folks there were very proud, like they knew about the research. So a lot of the folks that we met with and knew about Dan Buettner's work. And they were really proud of what they had done and what they had there, you know. And so they were proud of their culture, proud of their way of life. And so we're excited that sort of scientists were finding that and you know, not just kind of doing a typical scientific study about risk factors and what harms you, but I think flipping it on the positive side and saying, what are the things that are beneficial? What are the things that we can learn from? So they were, the folks that I met there, you know, were excited to share and excited that other people could learn from them.
It reminds me, I'm just thinking as you talk about kind of extreme longevity, my late grandmother lived to be 107 years old, and she died just over a year ago. And I remember in her 90s, like when I would ask her, even when she was in her late 90s, I would ask her, you know, how are you doing? And she would say, so far, so good. And when she turned 100, I asked her, like, what's the best part of being 100? And she said to me, there's no peer pressure. So she had this like amazing sense of humor. And I'm wondering how much a person's attitude, maybe a sense of humor or that sense of not taking oneself so seriously could be a contributor. Did you see that sort of a mindset in these communities?
Yeah, absolutely. I definitely saw that. And, you know, the people that I talked with both in Sardinia and in Costa Rica. And I would say that's another thing that comes out from some of the other studies that I've done too. And, you know, we've used something called sort of negative affect, which is sort of the opposite of that, which is sort of, you know, anything that happens, you know, having negative framing around that, which we found, you know, detrimental to longevity. And so sort of it makes sense that sort of the opposite would be true. So, and then, you know, other literature and psychology, I think that would support that too.
Okay, let's do it. Let's dig into the biology a little bit, and I will try and follow you. Can you tell us a bit about how these behaviors and this culture and this environment can actually affect the physiology of the residents of these blue zones?
Yeah, so the social environment, gets translated into an economic environment, into ways we behave, our, you know, mental state, and that in turn sort of can affect things in the body. And so it becomes sort of another way to tell the story rather than just sort of, so I think it's super important to just ask people how they're doing. Do they overall feel good? There's a lot of sort of quality of life measures. But that might not capture the full story. And there may be sort of changes, good or bad, within people, you know, in terms of their biology. And so it's not just people saying they're doing better, but also we see some sort of underlying patterns. And the one thing that we looked at a few times was telomere length. So there had been a number of studies showing that telomeres, which are the end of, which are repeated sequences at the end of chromosomes, that they degrade faster and result in cell death among people who are very, very stressed. Mm-hmm. And so folks have talked about it as sort of a biomarker of stress to sort of capture that. So in addition to what people report, so even if you thought you felt fine or sort of were in denial about your level of stress, we can sort of capture it from looking at telomere length and just sort of the average across cells. And so we saw differences in the sort of Nicoya region, the blue zone of Costa Rica, as compared to the rest of Costa Rica. So Costa Rica already, you know, overall is a very healthy country with a really long life expectancy. And by for some age groups, better than the US actually. But then in Nicoya, it's even better. And we found sort of longer telomere length in Nicoya.
Hmm. So if you had to sort of summarize, given all the social things you've seen and the biological markers you've examined, if you had to summarize what this magic sort of formula is for us, how would you summarize it?
Yeah, I think, you know, the magic formula is you know, being in a place that really supports you doing things that are good for your well-being and your health, if that makes sense. I think the people in Nicoya or other blue zones, and maybe your grandmother was like this, they're not trying real hard every day to be healthy, you know? They're kind of being who they are and living their lives, and they happen to live in a place that really supports that. And so I think it's a really important information and message for sort of public health and medicine to think about how we create these places that just make it easy for people to be healthy, and that you don't have to try, and you don't have to think, I got to get to the gym in 10 minutes. I got to like cook a healthy dinner. I got to rush around and end up more stressed than you would be otherwise. So I think, you know, to answer your question, I think that the kind of exciting thing about blue zones and then the work I do in social epidemiology is thinking about how we create these places that help people be happier and healthier.
And David, just because I love talking about food, tell me about the average diet. I'd love to dig into this kind of healthier behaviors so that we can maybe sort of try and adopt some of these healthier behaviors ourselves.
Yeah. So the things we see, you know, the number one thing is like not a lot of processed foods. Definitely not fast foods, but definitely not a lot of processed foods. You know, a balance between, you know, a lot of vegetables, you know, smaller amounts of meat. So generally that's, you know, I'm not sort of a dietary researcher, so don't want to like speculate too much about that, but at least that's what sort of I've seen when I've been there.
Yeah, no, that's what I'm asking, what you saw when you were there. That's
I love food too. Yeah.
It sounds very healthy. It sounds very healthy. Yeah. So, excellent. So, David, how have you changed the way you live your life after having visited these regions?
Wow, that is a great question. I would say I was always a pretty active person, but I've kind of tried to build that more into my life. So for me, the version of that is instead of driving to work the 20 minutes, riding my bike the 30 minutes, you know, it's like an extra 10 minutes just like bike commuting in. I mean, I did that a little bit before, but just sort of realized like, yeah, that's something that's kind of automatically built into my day. You know, once I'm at work and I'm really tired and I need to get home, I still need to ride my bike home. So, you know, I'm going to do it automatically. So I'd say on like the physical activity side, it's trying to kind of like build that in a little more naturally has been one of the lessons I've taken personally.
And what about stress management? Have you changed your ways to become more like a blue zone dweller?
I wish I could say that. You know, I think it's a great, you know, it's a great example of, you know, if you're in an environment that is asking a lot, expecting you to do a lot, you know, has a lot of sort of expectations, it's hard just kind of on your own to just change how stressed you are, at least for me. Mm-hmm. I would say one of the things that I've tried to do in terms of for other people, in terms of the people that I work with here, the people in my lab, of trying to create an environment that's less stressful for them, that, you know, that we take time to talk about sort of well-being and, you know, self-care, and that I try to give folks, you know, students or trainees or staff, to take a long view and say, you know, we're in it to do this work for like many, many years. We want to stay healthy. We want to stay motivated. And so, you know, just staying up till 2 a.m. every night trying to get our work done is not going to be sustainable. So as sort of a supervisor, a mentor, I'm trying to, you know, support that in my team. So that is a lesson that I've taken for sure.
So you're trying to create a micro blue zone for your
yeah.
Team. I love that. That's
you can definitely interview them too and see if they think it's true. But...
So David, I hear that you've been doing some research also in another blue zone in Sardinia. Can you tell us a little bit about that work?
Yeah. So some of the work we were doing there is looking at whether the sort of molecular impacts, the biological impacts, were exactly the same in Sardinia and then also Acaria in Greece with Costa Rica, so taking in Nicoya. So taking three blue zones and looking at the methylation patterns. And what we found is those methylation patterns were somewhat similar, but kind of unique in each of those places, which meant that there were sort of not just like one way to be a blue zone. One interpretation of that is there isn't just one way to be a blue zone, but there's a lot of different ways that things could come together. And so there are these differences between the blue zones, even though each of them has sort of achieved this kind of very interesting high longevity.
And were there between the different blue zones, are there certain striking similarities that you would say the one thing that these places all have in common is X?
Yeah, so not on the molecular side, which is interesting, but on the sort of behavioral side, I think, you know, those connections, a diet of non-processed sort of healthier foods, and then, you know, people being active and sort of moving naturally. And then as we talked about earlier, also that kind of like sense of purpose, you know, whatever that might be, and sort of a reason to get up in the morning and just, yeah.
What would be like if you had to give our audience members a few key takeaways from what you've learned that maybe they could implement in their lives? What would you say to someone just living, you know, in a, let's say, a bigger city, maybe with the typical amount of stress? And you're right that it's difficult to be the lone island that tries to do things differently when everybody around you is racing.
Yeah.
So how can we do better?
Yeah, I'll say there's two sides to that. The one side is, yeah, things for you personally. Building in sort of movement and walking. If you take the train or take public transportation, you're probably going to have a walk to that station, walk to the train. You know, that's going to build in those steps. You know, I don't think you ever need to be obsessive about sort of a step count or a step watch or anything. But if that helps you kind of realize like how active you are, how non-active you are, that can be helpful. I mean, I just have this as my watch anyway, but sometimes like when I'm traveling for work and I have a lot of conferences and meetings, you know, I look down, I'm like, wow, this has been like 3 days with 500 steps. Like I need to kind of get out and rebuild it. So thinking about those kind of things, you know, in terms of diet, I think one of the things is just, you talked about micro blue zones. Your own house can really be a micro blue zone. Just like, don't buy that unhealthy food. I mean, when I'm tired and exhausted and it's like 10 at night and I'm working and I see that like bag of chips in the cupboard, I mean, I'm going to eat that, you know, but if it's not there and there's only healthy things around, I'm like, well, I'm not running down to the store for that, you know? And, and so I think just like having a new view of those environments that are around you. Another thing, like at my office, so there's like this vending machine downstairs and like, folks have like candy out there. But if I like buy some healthy food and like have it in my office available when I get hungry, just makes it easier. So like doing those things, I think can make it easier on yourself. And they don't even feel like a lot of effort or having to do anything extra. It's just like you make it easier on yourself. The second part of that is, you know, how you go, I think, from just your own like micro areas to what you sort of advocate for and see in your community. So this can be as simple as sort of, you know, there's a public hearing about putting in bike lanes or fixing sidewalks, you know, so more people could, you know, advocating for safer neighborhoods, you know, advocating for a grocery store to come in. And so, you know, those can just be like little things. I mean, it could be sort of like an hour a month or something that you kind of see what's around, think about your community and how you can make that. And then that'll benefit everyone living in your neighborhood.
Excellent. Such good tips. Okay. I have a couple of profound questions for you and your time to answer these. In those moments where you are, let's say, overwhelmed and feeling like you have, you know, too many things on your to-do list, what fuels your passion for this work?
So I come back to, you know, how we can use data and how we can use science to improve people's well-being and make the world a better place. So that's very motivating. I don't know if I do that most of the time, but I try. And I think this kind of came from, you know, I talked about my experience early on about, you know, seeing different parts of Washington State. The other like important part of like growing up was the time I spent with my grandfather, who was an engineer. And we spent a lot of time with him just like building things and fixing things. And, you know, the thing that I learned from him is like, you know, you think about it enough, you work on it hard enough, like, you can fix something, you can build anything. And so I kind of like combine those experiences together into really wanting to take action, do something to make things better. So not just studying things, but really kind of a bit more of an engineering perspective, like how can we design things differently? How can we have an impact on the world to make things better for people and help people be healthier?
That sounds wonderful. It sounds like he really taught you to be curious and innovative at the same time. Here's to amazing grandparents, right?
Yeah, absolutely. All of my grandparents are amazing. I learned from all four of them.
Lovely. David, I'm so grateful to you for taking the time to chat with us today. And I'm going to, I think, let you go at this stage, unless there's anything I forgot to ask you.
No, thanks so much. I mean, I guess the only thing I would add is that I think it's important to think about blue zones, not just as places that used to be there, but like what we can create now and how we can sort of create blue zones everywhere and help people live healthier lives.
Thank you so much for your time, David. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Today's conversation explored the research of David Rakopf and his colleagues on blue zones, places in the world where certain social and health behaviors support unusually long and healthy lives. My big takeaways? Your behavior affects not just how you feel, but your molecular self, And you don't need to live in a blue zone to experience the benefits of certain blue zone behavioral characteristics. Thank you for listening to Stanford Medicine's Health Compass podcast. If you like what you heard today and want to keep up with Health Compass, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or the Stanford Medicine YouTube channel.